for anyone who's here, who wasn't here last week, we had about a quarter or third of the Dharma talk was in the dark last week. So, good. So I'll begin, okay? So I was looking at the request that we compiled a few months ago for themes to explore on these Sunday nights. And we had probably 30 or 40 themes. And I looked at the ones that were mentioned the most and thought to explore at least one of those this evening. And the theme which I chose for this evening is that of equanimity, which means keeping balance no matter what happens internally or externally. So I won't say that the choice of the theme has caused the power failure, but there is a correlation between that theme and the fact that the circumstances are not typical now. And interestingly, last time we looked at the theme of generosity, also to some extent gratitude, and in the list of the paramis, or the core virtues or perfections that are mentioned in this very ancient list from the Buddha called the paramis, in Mahayana tradition called the paramitas, the virtues or perfections, generosity is the first, and equanimity is the last. So we may come back to the middle qualities a little later. But we're doing our quick survey of the first and last of the paramis. And so equanimity is actually very important and powerful quality. Again, it's ultimately a sense of balance, no matter what happens internally or externally. And it's mentioned in the list of the Buddha a number of times, and it's always the last one. It's the last of the seven factors of awakening. It's the last of the paramis. It's the last of the Brahmavihara, the stations of the heart. And I've heard it said that equanimity is a state that's quite close to Nibbana or Nirvana or the sacred. Again, it's this quality of being able to be very present, very clear, very responsive, and yet non-reactive. So what I want to do this evening is to talk about seven qualities of equanimity. The first of them is balance. The second is a kind of evenness. The third is a kind of unshakability, no matter what happens. The fourth is understanding and wisdom. The fifth is a kind of faith. And then the sixth and the seventh are particularly connected with aspects of equanimity which are often misunderstood or confusing. The sixth of them has to do with the fact that equanimity still is very much connected with the heart. So a typical distortion of equanimity would be that it's disconnected from the heart. Or one person told me, when she thinks of equanimity, it sounds suspicious, that it sounds like a Buddhist quality that sounds like one's on Prozac all the time. Right? You don't feel anything, but you're balanced, right? And so the sixth quality of really being grounded in the heart is, in a sense, a corrective to that possible misunderstanding or distortion of equanimity. And then the seventh is responsiveness and action, which is also a way of seeing a very, very common misunderstanding of equanimity, that it's aloof and indifferent and kind of separated from being responsive and active, that it's sort of the ivory tower or on the mountain attitude, which again is a misunderstanding. So I want to go through those seven qualities and along the way identify a set of practices which we might do in the next week. I'm sorry it's harder to take notes about all this. And of course, it's harder for me to read my notes. But I'm doing okay so far. So the first of the, or maybe I should back up and say, and just talk about these questions. Again, equanimity really can be question, and I think there's something also about the very word equanimity, which is not a word that we use in English very much. It's kind of a strange word, and it can sound like we are just sort of aloof, indifferent, unemotional. You know, and that, okay, this happens in the world, this happened personally, you know, I'm a little bit robotic, I'm a robotic, aloof meditator. Things happen internally or people close to me and I don't really feel them. Or things happen in the world that are, you know, very disastrous, linked with a lot of suffering. And I have my middle class escapist equanimity. Right? And then in fact, I remember talking particularly with people from what we would call the third world, particularly from Thailand and Latin America, who actually were a little worried that Buddhism would be a kind of middle-class escapism in the U.S. There's certainly that danger. And so equanimity, when we look at it deeply, we'll see how equanimity really is connected with the heart and is responsive. And one of the ways that we can practice is to really check, is my balance, is my equanimity connected with my heart, and is it connected with action? So that's what I'll emphasize as the most common challenges or distortions. So I'll go through these seven qualities. That'll be the structure of the talk, and I'm glad I remembered that's what I was doing. But equanimity has been such a favorite topic of mine that when the lights went out, I wasn't worried. I had some degree of equanimity. And I'm able to act, and hopefully it's heartfelt. We'll see. Okay, so quality number one is balance. And literally, equanimity means, in the original language of the Buddha, or the discourses in Pali, the word is upekkha, which means balance. One of my students once wrote a kind of a ditty about equanimity, and he talked of developing hekka upekkha. And so upekkha is the word meaning balance, and it's a sense of being able to be essentially non-reactive. Non-reactive would be also a good synonym for equanimity, that we can actually be present, be there, and be non-reactive. So this points to one of the ways that we practice equanimity, which is that we practice equanimity by seeing where we lose balance, in fact, where we're not even, where we are shaken around, and so forth, where the qualities are not present. Interestingly, the way that we develop equanimity is actually studying how we lose it, studying how we are reactive, in this case, studying how we don't have balance. And so, again, it's one of the features of our practice that our times of being unbalanced or reactive or losing it, once we take up the intention of practice, we embrace the times that we're lost or stuck. We don't always remember immediately, but that's really the big picture of our practice, that we are there for everything. As it says in the Tibetan, Lojong teaches, turn all obstacles into the path of practice. Not so easy, is it, right? Mm-hmm. Right? Not so easy at all. When we get lost or stuck, we often say, you know, we often forget about our practice or think, oh, my practice isn't working or whatever. But that's really the larger picture, always to remember. You know, and that's where community can play a large role, you know, to really help us to investigate what's difficult or where we're lost. Again, very big part of equanimity that we learn by studying as much as we can where we get lost. Using mindfulness. Mindfulness of reactivity is not reactive. That's what we can always remember. Or it reminds me of that famous, the famous Mark Twain quotation, which I like because it's connected with the theme of the judgmental mind. And I probably have said it here in teaching on the judgmental mind. It goes like this. Good judgment depends on experience. Experience depends on bad judgment. Or experience comes from bad judgment. Right. And so we can cultivate that non-reactivity, especially by looking carefully at where we lose balance. Reactivity, difficult emotions. So we study anger, we study sadness, we study fear. And that's not easy. It's not, again, what many of us signed up for with our practice. I know when I signed up for meditation, I signed up for mostly bliss and understanding and wisdom without any issues. I was in my 20s and naive and soon learned better, but I think we know better. So the second quality of equanimity is evenness, which is really related. And that really means that we treat everything, in a sense, the same. Okay, blissful moment, wonderful. Reactive moment, oh, I can be with that. That's, again, goes against our conditioning, doesn't it? And we have to really practice. And I remember one time when I really noticed that evenness, and it surprised me. I think it was on a retreat, on a longer retreat. And I think I was just so delighted to be on retreat that I sincerely did not care what happened. You know, and I saw, oh, that can be brought into daily life. And so I remember one morning in this retreat, I hadn't slept well. I didn't feel good in my body, and I was irritable. All of those conditions were there, and I was really happy and contented, and said, whoa, what's that about? It's basically, one way of talking about it is that there's an evenness with whatever's there. We could say also non-reactivity with whatever's there. You know, in the terms of the teaching that we often come to hear, I wasn't shooting the second arrow at any of the first arrow phenomena, meaning I wasn't causing more pain by something that was, in a sense, unpleasant. So we have that evenness. And there's a haiku that I like a lot. Let's see if I can remember it from Basho, which to me is an equanimity evenness haiku. It goes like this. Fleas, lice, the horse pissing near my pillow. Okay, that's it. Remember, haiku are only 17 syllables, right? Fleas, lice, the horse pissing near my pillow, which I interpret as an equanimity haiku because there's evenness towards everything. He's not shooting the second arrow in relation to the horse, right? Or the fleas or the lice. Does that make some sense? So evenness is an important quality. I think it was around this time in the talk last week that the lights came back on. We will see. This looks like the power outage is a little more serious this week. We will see. Okay, is anyone, excuse me.
May I ask a question?
You could.
Thank you.
If it's a question of clarification, especially if it's a substantive question, I'll like to leave it to the end.
You can leave it till the end.
Okay. Yeah, if it's a question of clarification, that's okay. But why don't we try it? We'll see. Why don't you try it? Your question.
Oh, okay. I don't know how to hold irritability in myself and still have equanimity with it. Seems contradictory.
How to have irritability and equanimity at the same time? Remember that equanimity is really about non-reactivity. So the question is, can you have non-reactivity in relation to irritability? And I'm sure you've had that many, many times, particularly in meditation, right? You're sitting, you feel irritable, but you say, okay, I'm irritable. Let me track the irritability in my body. Let me watch it in the mind. And so mindfulness of irritability is not irritable. In other words, it can have qualities of equanimity. Does that make some sense? So I think you've experienced it.
It makes some sense. I guess I don't really know.
Don't know if you've experienced
it. Do it in everyday life.
Yeah. Right. The key would be the mindfulness. The key would be finding a way to have non-reactivity in relation to what's difficult or challenging. So it'd be some form of reactivity, difficult emotions, difficult narratives in the mind. Can I have some space around them? If I have no space around them, then there's no equanimity. You know, another metaphor for equanimity is being spacious. Right? Can I be spacious with my irritability? I certainly was spacious that morning that I'm talking about. Right? There really was irritability. Mm-hmm. Another way to look and see whether it's there's some degree of equanimity is whether you're shooting the second arrow. You know, to use that. Not everyone probably knows that teaching. That's that idea of not adding difficulty to already existing difficulty, not reacting a second time to a first reaction, in other words. Okay. So maybe we can come back to that and look at that. So a third quality of equanimity is unshakability, that we are increasingly able to be with what happens and in a sense keep our center. Or maybe another way of saying it is come back to our center as soon as possible. And there's that way that we can not be taken out of our center so easily, increasingly. When I did the book that's on the table called The Engaged Spiritual Life, I did about 15 interviews with people who had deep grounding in spirituality, were also generally activists in the world. And they all had a certain kind of unshakability, which in large part came from years and years of experience and coming back to their centers. And it made it hard for anything to really knock them around too much. And again, that's a quality of equanimity, that we can not be knocked around for too long. Maybe we're knocked around some, but we come back. And increasingly, it's hard to knock us around. You know, that we can have that quality of unshakability. A fourth quality of equanimity is what I would call understanding or wisdom. And equanimity really is a very strong wisdom quality. There's a way that we see the conditions that are happening. And there's some wisdom about it. We can see, oh, maybe I'm reactive, and maybe we know ourselves better to say, oh, that's a familiar pattern of my own reactivity. I know that. You know, you know, it comes from this conditioning, and I've looked at it a lot, and I can understand what's going on. So understanding of causes and conditions is a really important aspect of equanimity. You know, I can see maybe in an interpersonal difficulty or conflict, I can see, oh, yeah, I see, I know I have these tendencies, that person has those tendencies, and we're actually starting to be reactive towards each other. And that understanding can help me not to be as reactive. You know, there was a, I saw this really clearly quite a few years ago, I remember, when I was teaching in a graduate school, and I had a person in the graduate school who was like, I used to think of him as my nemesis. Anyone have a nemesis?
Yes.
You know? Yep. Yep. And so this guy, whenever I would have a good idea, he was in an administrative position, and he would generally, I thought, squash my good ideas. I had really great ideas for this project or that project. He would say, yeah, I'm not sure. You know, I'm not sure we want to do that, or I don't think we want to put the resources there. And I remember, you know, this went on for some years. I remember having a conversation one morning, and the same thing happened. You know, I had a great idea, I thought, and he thought otherwise, and put some, as it were, cold water on the idea. And I noticed myself starting to get reactive. And at a certain point I said, you know, actually pretty soon, that particular morning, it was a little different, I said, I'm going the same route that I've gone quite a number of times. You know, he has his history for why he's doing what he's doing, and the institution has its causes and conditions, and I have my history, and here we are. We're getting into that again, right? And that helped me to have balance and equanimity, and really I actually stopped being reactive at that point. Again, this we may need to investigate. We may need to look carefully. You know, there was something that was actually troubling me yesterday, and I could notice myself getting into some old conditioning. It was a conditioning where I sometimes go. I won't go into the specifics, but where it's I sometimes have a condition that, oh, I'm different and I don't quite belong. Anyone have that conditioning? Anyone raise your hand? I can see you in the dark, yeah. And so there was something happening and I could feel myself going into that. And it's hard to, when you go into that, it's kind of hard to get out sometimes, right? Do you know that one? Right? That, and I could feel that. And I talked with a close friend and we did a form of inquiry. Actually, we used a method developed by Byron Katie. Anyone know some of her work? Right. A very interesting work. So it basically has one take what is leading one to be reactive and, first of all, try to identify a core belief. I do something very similar, as many of you know, in the work with judgments. And so we were able to identify a core belief having to do with, you know, being different, not being, you know, being, not being understood, and so forth. And then we actually took the further steps, which were to, I forget what they all were, but there was a form of inquiry where I would look into what do you feel when that is strong, you know, and then some of you probably know the different steps better than me. But we also went to a step where you reverse it and you say, what would it be like if, you know, I thought that of them? Or what would it be like if I reversed it in certain ways? And it took me, it was very interesting. And I got to really have a sense in that of the particular nature of that conditioning in a way that by the end of 10 or 15 minutes of doing that practice, that conditioning wasn't there in the same way. So sometimes we need to do a kind of inquiry to move out of that conditioning and come more to understanding. And it's that wisdom aspect, which is also part of equanimity. A fifth quality is a kind of faith. That there's a way that as we cultivate more equanimity, we can really experience more and more a confidence. I like actually the word in the original language is shraddha, and I like the word confidence rather than faith as a translation, because faith is kind of a loaded term in the Western tradition. And so there's a kind of confidence in our own capacity to be with whatever's coming up that very much develops. We can have a confidence that we can touch our deeper qualities no matter what happens. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that beautiful? That's part of equanimity, that I can actually stay connected with my deeper qualities even if things get hard, even if they're difficult experiences. To the extent that we've cultivated equanimity, that's there more and more. So that quality of faith can be there. And a sense, really being in touch with our deeper vision of the nature of things, of the core qualities in our being, that can be there more and more. So now we come to the sixth and seventh qualities, which are being connected with the heart and being able to be responsive and act. And like I said, these are the ones that can be more confusing for us. We can think that equanimity sounds like we're disconnected from our heart, like I said, as if on Prozac. You know, sort of disconnected and so forth. You know, it would be like, as it were, if the lights of the heart went out. And didn't come on for a while. What would that be like? Would you have equanimity? Or would you be able to sit in the darkness of the heart with balance? Maybe. So, interestingly, in the traditional teachings on the stations of the heart, the so-called Brahma-vihara, the divine abodes, loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity, it said that each of those has what's called, as many of you know, a near enemy or a near opposite or a kind of distortion of these qualities. They're not totally off, but they're distorted. So the near enemy of loving kindness is a kind of possessiveness or grasping. You know, a love that is possessive or grasping. There's still love, but it's not fully genuine. For compassion, the near enemy is pity. It's distance. It's not really sincere, deeply sincere compassion, but there's some compassion there. For joy, there's what it's usually translated as exuberance, which I don't like so much, but it's a sense of being really attached to one's joy. I'm so cool, I'm so joyful. You know. And then the near enemy of indifference, the near enemy of equanimity is indifference. Isn't that interesting? It's the cutting off from the heart. And one of the beautiful aspects of this teaching of these four qualities of the heart is that each of them have to be present for each of the others for any given quality to be mature. So loving kindness has to have aspects of compassion, joy, and equanimity to be mature. We can see that kind of clearly, like with compassion. If we're hanging out with a certain amount of pain, like in the helping professions, if we don't have a certain amount of joy and equanimity, for example, that gives us balance, we're going to get burned out, right? So this is a very beautiful and subtle teaching. And it really points to the way that equanimity has to have the qualities of kindness and the quality of compassion, the quality of joy, for it to really be mature. You know, I love that teaching. It's a very subtle teaching, isn't it? That the open heart has to be a wise heart, we might say. And that wisdom has to be really connected with the heart. That equanimity without that connection is immature. And so it's a wonderful, wonderful aspect of this teaching that equanimity has to really be deeply caring. Some of my colleagues I've heard speak of equanimity as being like the wise grandmother who's basically seen everything, is not knocked around by anything, but still cares. All that experience hasn't taken her out of her kind heart. That's equanimity. So it has that quality of the kind heart being there. And then the last aspect of equanimity is its responsiveness. Also, again, could be misunderstood. It could be that it's indifferent. And when I was working on this book, The Engaged Spiritual Life, I was very interested in equanimity and how it gets connected with action. And I found, actually, in researching that book, I have essentially two chapters on equanimity in the book. And one of the findings from doing the writing and thinking about the book was that there actually are multiple near enemies that weren't listed traditionally, that I found, you know, particularly in the context of the misunderstanding about action being involved, I found there were a lot of other near enemies that one could mention. So, for example, complacency is a kind of near enemy of equanimity, isn't it? I can be complacent, so I'm not really responsive. Another one would be detachment. I'm kind of overly detached, and I'm not really responsive. I feel equanimous, but I'm really separate from things. And I thought that some aspects also of privilege can look like equanimity. I live high on the hill, where I live in the ivory tower, and I'm above the suffering of most people. And I'm so equanimous, aren't I? Right? So that's a danger, right? That could be another near enemy. And so equanimity in its deepest form, especially guided by its internalized compassion, is going to be active, is going to be responsive. We'll be able to be balanced and non-reactive, but still responsive. And so again, a very, very deep quality. Again, in doing the book, I found that so many of the people I interviewed manifested that quality of equanimity in the midst of action. You know? And again, a lot of times it came out of a history of having had difficult experiences from which one learned something. I remember that one of the people I interviewed was Dr. Ariaratne from Sri Lanka, who founded Sarvodaya. And he had mentioned how he took everything as learning. When you take everything as learning, you're going to cultivate equanimity. He said, I take everything as learning, and even if people externally think that I fail, for me, nothing is truly a failure if I have the motivation to learn from it. Externally, it may look like failure, but perhaps in that so-called failure, I learned something. I learned something about, maybe about even about equanimity or compassion. And I kept on going. You know, and I found a lot of the people I interviewed, they told stories like that. And there was a way that many of the people we most revere as deeply spiritually grounded activists or people of action, I think people like Dr. King or Nelson Mandela, you can see when you look at their lives how there was a deep responsiveness coupled with a very powerful equanimity. And maybe I had something I was going to read to close, but I think that is not accessible. But so I think I'll tell a story. And this is a story of Dr. King. Okay. And this happened in 1962 or 63, maybe earlier, but Dr. King had been receiving death threats, and he talked about, you can listen to this. Oh, you know what? I forgot something, probably. This is the, I forgot one part of my outline that I want to do before the story, okay? So I have a slight rewind. And then the thing that I wanted to mention was how to practice equanimity, how to intentionally cultivate equanimity in the next week, because that's what I'm going to invite you to do. You know, I hope that you do it sometimes in the dark, sometimes in the light. Okay, so here are a few ways to cultivate equanimity. And again, a lot of it is cultivated by seeing where we're non-equanimous. So one way of cultivating equanimity is to just do our ordinary mindfulness practice. Our ordinary mindfulness practice is a way of being balanced with whatever comes up. Now, one thing I should say that's something I say often that's really important is that when we're being mindful of something difficult, it's really crucial to know when mindfulness is actually possible and when it's not. Sometimes we're so knocked around by something that mindfulness doesn't really work. And then we have to try to come back to balance. I may be so lost in something that I can't be mindful, I can't be equanimous. And it's really important to be mindful enough to know that. Okay? So that has to be said. But in our ordinary mindfulness practice, we're essentially trying to be balanced and equanimous with whatever comes up. So we can do that simply by continually practicing mindfulness. A second aspect of equanimity practice is to see when we are reactive, to try in our mindfulness practice in daily life to track whenever we become reactive. And even to know what are my five main forms of reactivity. So first, being mindful. Second, really studying reactivity. It's a wonderful daily life practice. You can have the intention, I'm going to really look out for whenever I become reactive and try to bring mindfulness to it. And we can probably do that with the times that we're less reactive. The really big ones may be harder. So a second way of practicing is to look out for reactivity. Third way of practicing is to look out for difficult emotions, often connected with reactivity, but particularly look out when there are challenging emotions and see how to be mindful of them, be present with them. Notice when you lose it, notice when you're reactive. So that's a third way. Another way of working with to develop equanimity, it's related to what I've just said, but it's related to that particular teaching called the teaching of the eight worldly winds. So many of you know that teaching? Mm-hmm. How many of you know that teaching? If you can raise your hand. This is a teaching that identifies essentially the eight conditions which knock us out of our equanimity, which knock us out of balance. And they come under what we've been talking about. They are pleasure and pain, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, and praise and blame. And so what we could do in this form of practice is we set up our radar to look for when we get knocked around by any of these. And you'll see that there are four groupings. Each of them have a more positive, and some of them have a more negative. And so it's also important to see that we get knocked out of equanimity not just by the difficult or the unpleasant, but also by the pleasant, right? Haven't mentioned that much tonight, have I? Interesting. But we get knocked out of equanimity by the pleasant as well, right? By the grasping, by the just getting totally caught in the pleasant. That's harder to see for most of us. We can see more easily how we get stuck with the unpleasant. So we look for whenever we get caught in the pleasant or caught in the unpleasant. Caught in a sense of, oh, this is going well, gain. Oh, this isn't going well, loss. See how we get stuck there. See how we get stuck with fame or disrepute. Good image of me, bad image of me. Right? And then maybe what might be one of the most powerful for many of us, praise and blame. Right? Look for when you get knocked around by praise and blame. So a very powerful way to practice equanimity is to set your intention, set your radar, to look out for these eight conditions. It's a powerful way to practice. can really look for it. Look out for these. And there's another way, which maybe I'll look at next week, which is more the quality of developing equanimity as a heart practice, as a Brahma-vihara, as a practice that's done something like metta. So those are five ways of practicing. Some of you know the last one. I'll go more into that next time. And maybe even be able to read some quotations. It's possible, although it's interesting that the power failure is occurring just at this time. Yeah. So those are essentially five ways of practice. And I want to urge us to take on one or two of those first four ways of practicing. That is, the first one is just our ordinary mindfulness and really intending to cultivate equanimity with whatever comes up in our ordinary mindfulness practice. Second, really work to track reactivity, both in meditation, in formal meditation, and during the day. It's a great practice during the day to have the intention to track reactivity. Third, work with difficult emotions and see if you can be mindful of these and track these. And fourth, practicing with the eight worldly winds. You practice with those four, equanimity will grow. And then the fifth, which I'll look at next time, is equanimity as a heart practice. Okay, so the story. Dr. King had been getting death threats. And he was up late one night. His wife and children were asleep. I don't know if he had one child or two children at that time. And at that time, it was very dark. It was midnight. And someone called him and said, used the N-word, and said, if you're not out of town, he had been leading a desegregation march. I don't know if this was the Montgomery bus boycott. I'm sorry, maybe it's in my notes, but I don't feel like looking at them. In any case, he received a call. A person said, if you're not out of town, your house is going to be bombed, and we'll kill all of you. And they didn't have answering machines, or, you know, he couldn't see the telephone number of the person calling. He answered it, and he was really knocked around by that. He definitely lost his equanimity. And he was there at his kitchen table. It was midnight. And he thought to himself, I should just quit. You know, this is too dangerous. I don't want my family killed, you know. I should just do what this person says and leave town. And he thought like that, and he thought, you know, I can't call on my parents. They're, you know, a few hundred miles away in Atlanta. He was in Birmingham, Alabama. I can't call on them, you know. I'm by myself. Nothing's going to help. And then something in him was open to some other dimension of things. And he said that he actually started hearing the voice of Jesus speaking to him and said, Martin Luther, you are doing good work, and I will stay with you no matter what happens. And he said that something shifted at that moment. And he had a certain balance. So this is connected with tradition, with the faith aspect, the confidence aspect of equanimity. And something, you know, we could interpret that in various ways. We could say he touched a deep level of his being, which came out as, you know, in Christian kind of archetypal experience. And after that, actually 3 days after that, his house was bombed. And he Luckily, no one was hurt, but his house was bombed. And he had a press conference, and people were incredibly struck by the level of equanimity that he had. It was just this deep quality of presence. He was not angry. He was very present, very committed to action. And he said that the experience from a few days before that had been completely formative for him being able to be so present and equanimous at that point. And of course, that was part of a long time. That experience came about after, you know, years of spiritual practice. Right? And so I'll leave us with that story and open it up to questions and discussion. My hope is that we feel energized to take on the practice of cultivating more equanimity. You know, I'll come back later near the end and repeat those four types of practice that I'm suggesting we work with. So questions, comments, you know, anything about equanimity? I'm going to come back to that irritability. Can I be equanimous with irritability? Yeah.
Just that I noticed that when the power went out, it seemed like, I'm just sort of interpreting now what happened, but it seemed like the work, I didn't realize how much work goes into all the visual processing that goes on when the lights are on.
Yeah.
Just listening to a talk and having that be gone.
That's right.
Was, and I don't know if I felt this greater equanimity or greater calmness, but it was a very different experience.
But you had enough equanimity to have that quality of understanding that it is a little different sitting in the dark hearing a talk. It's a different experience for me sitting in the dark giving a talk, right? I can hear you, but I can't see your faces to know which of the comments are landing more or landing less or which of you are getting antsy, whatever, you know. And so there's a lot there, and this is a little bit like it's like hearing a talk of a recording with your eyes closed. Yeah, and it's missing some information, isn't it? Yeah.
And thank you.
Yeah.
Realizing that too, that can have been easy to do that talk
without
your
mouth. Right. And equanimity has been such a favorite topic of mine. If I had chosen another topic where I was more dependent on my notes, I wouldn't have had so much equanimity. It's interesting, yeah. But before I came, I actually, the structure that I worked out for today actually is one that I've never done for an equanimity talk. In the same way, and but I just thought I wanted to keep it sort of simple, and so I remembered the structure, which is very handy. It's so, you know, I like to. Sometimes I like to think of my talks as a little bit like jazz. So they have a structure, but within that, whatever happens around that structure is fine. Okay. And tonight I had no choice. So other. Comments, questions related to equanimity? Yeah, I think we could use a better word. I think equanimity is a weird word in English. We don't use it much, right? Literally, I looked it up once in the Oxford English Dictionary, and it comes from the 16th century English, meaning evenness. You know, so we know equa, the beginning of it means equal. Right. Okay, Patty.
So my question is, I think this is cheating, but sometimes when I want to find equanimity, I avoid the triggers. Like some days I just don't bring myself to look at the news because I know it will just stir me up. So it's not really cultivating equanimity, it's just choosing not to go where I know I'll be thrown off balance.
Mm-hmm.
Or avoiding certain people if I don't want to have that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of like cheating. It's doing a detour around what would trigger me to lose my equanimity.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes I just feel like I'm not up for that challenge.
That's it's a great question, really, a great point, really, because probably, like many of you, I could see that being both something very helpful in some ways and not helpful in others, right? Helpful in what we might call the total ecology of our minds, right? Helpful for the general equanimity to not get overloaded with things that make us reactive. That's very helpful, right? And so, but that would be something where we would have some boundaries, you know. And it's actually with a lot of people I work with, we talk about this, right? And when I just came back from traveling and doing quite a few weekends on socially engaged practice, where we went right into pretty thick issues and people mentioned a lot of hard things. And having that kind of balance in relation to the news is important. So on the one hand, it could be very skillful to help you have a larger equanimity to set some boundaries, right? Of course, if you say, let's not go there at all, then it could be a problem. Or if you set the boundaries always so that you use it, as it were, to support maybe tendencies or conditioning to avoid conflict, right? Or if we knew we have that conditioning to be avoidant of conflict, which is probably most of us, right? I certainly was raised with that conditioning. Then that could be an issue, right? So we want to really know ourselves well enough to know when that strategy is skillful and when it's not skillful. So but it's great to name it. It's pretty interesting. Yeah.
I'm wondering if one of the aspects of equanimity is surrender,
mm-hmm.
because I've had experiences in the few weeks, particularly where I've been under pressure, time pressure to get something completed,
mm-hmm.
that specifically has to do with moving,
mm-hmm.
and 1,000 things that have to be done. And I'm finding that there are times when I feel really equanimous and other times where things are going wrong that are getting in my way of getting things completed, and I'm losing it for a minute or two where I'm feeling exasperated. And then I kind of reach, I think there's an aspect of faith where I'm saying, I'm sort of talking to my angels and just saying, I really need your help because, you know, or else this isn't going to happen and I don't know what I'm going to do. And then I think the next moment is like a surrender. And I'm not sure that is part of an aspect of equanimity, because I'm finding that I'm just having to let go a lot at some point of things and just assuming they're going to work out because I don't have a choice.
Yeah, I think it's a great addition to this that, you know, I mentioned. I think the fifth quality I named is that of faith, and I think surrender is in that territory, right? I talked about confidence, and I think also I like that way that you were in a way asking for help. You can ask for help from friends, community. You know, sometimes some people might ask, like King got help from Jesus. Some people might get help from Kuan Yin, or go to a more archetypal level, right? That's or do chanting in some way. Some people. In a lot of Buddhist cultures, that would be done, right? And so I think that there are really two aspects there. One of them is that one can sometimes get support to help one be equanimous with something quite challenging. So I think that's an important. You know, you were focusing more on surrender, but I wanted to bring out that point that came out of your question. And then surrender would be connected with that faith that I have enough equanimity that I don't need to have that close control over the situation. You know, I have enough balance, equanimity, and faith, so I don't need to micromanage, or I don't need to have so much control. I can just say, you know, I will just let this happen, or maybe I don't know what's happening, but I will just be there and use my best resources. And there's a kind of surrender there that can be very, very deep quality. You know, I was actually thinking yesterday I'm going to be co-teaching a day long at Spirit Rock on the dark night of the soul in beginning of March, which is a pretty powerful theme. You know, the phrase comes from St. John of the Cross in Catholic mystical tradition, and it's about these times when we can feel quite lost. It's actually in the tradition. The dark night is understood as something that only happens when we're fairly mature. And it sort of can take one out of a rote allegiance to spiritual practice, and something deeper gets formed, but it takes a surrender for that to happen. It's then a surrender with challenging conditions. So I think it's a great point there. Thank you. That's part of it. Maybe time for one more before we do the meta cards. Yeah, please.
You know, it just hit me. I wonder if it's easier, if it's a female quality that's more easily accessed by women than men. Surrender. I was just thinking about it in relation to myself, that surrender is like the last thing I want to do.
Yeah.
If I'm a man, it's just a male kind of gets in the way of things. For a man to surrender as opposed for a woman, I don't know.
So, but you sense that in looking at yourself?
Yeah.
It's a great question. Are there gender dimensions of equanimity, right? It's a wonderful question. How many can relate to that question? Maybe think that there may be some ways, you know, are men more conditioned to be controlling? I don't know. I mean,
some women are.
Yeah. But equanimity, surrender is just would be one dimension of it, I think. So control, but obviously, anyone can be quite controlling, either gender. But are there forms of conditioning related to gender or other aspects of conditioning, which can make equanimity either harder or less hard? It's really interesting. Maybe. You know, we don't have so much time now, we should get to the meta cards, but maybe we look at that for the next week, okay? And we can come back. I may give some thought to that. Okay? I like the question. Thank you so much. Yeah.